Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
I'm Sharon Martinetti, and welcome to our first episode of The Churn. So each week, Adam Swiderski and I, say hi, Adam.
Hi, Adam.
Again, we'll be joined by Expanse creators Ty Frank and Daniel Abraham, a.k.a. James S.A. Corey, and a special guest to be determined to break down the latest episode in season two of The Expanse. So we have a double episode premiere because basically, I guess it's Christmas in February. And we're kicking off season two with a double episode that, safe to say, there's a lot going on. Holden and Miller are receiving treatment for radiation exposure on Eros, and Holden is definitely having some interesting side effects. Alex continues to be the light in everyone's life, providing both the comic relief and lasagna. Miller and Amos work through their feelings, and Naomi and Holden put in a little bit of work of their own. Christian tugs on a couple of strings like the puppet master she is. We learn more about Fred Johnson, a.k.a. the Butcher of Anderson Station, and we get a pretty impressive space battle. And last but definitely not least, we have Bobby Motherfrackin' Draper making her debut. So we got politics, we got sex, we got showdowns. There was a lot. What was your favorite part?
All of it. No, I was just glad to see the Expanse back. I mean, it's been a long time since the end of season one, and we're back in space. I loved everything. I loved the Martian Marines on Mars. We kicked right off with some power armor. We got a great space battle. The politics stepped things up a notch. I think it was a real confident and propulsive debut for season two. I'm into it, man. I'm ready.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a great premiere. I like that the episode built up to that awesome space battle, which looked fantastic. The special effects continue to look amazing on this show.
Really, for cable TV? I mean, It's not like HBO. It was really
It's not
impressive.
HBO. It's cable TV.
You know what I mean. I see what you did there.
Okay, thank you. Bobby, you know, Frankie looks amazing as Bobby. We got some sex, and, you know, I'm all about seeing Steven's bare ass. So, you know, that was not... That was not a low light for me for the episode.
It's interesting because I was more drawn to the abs. So yeah. I think it's like, you know,
no, I mean,
that's kind of like
he
the Rorschach. It's the Rorschach test of the Expanse is like, what part of Steven Strait
in
are you most
in all fairness, though, Dominique's got a pretty amazing ass, too. So he has some competition now.
That's true.
And let's see what else. I guess.
Where do you go from there, really?
You know, where do you go? Speaking of asses, Ty and Daniel say hi.
Hi. That was for the record book.
I meant it with love. You know that.
That's because I made you re-record the opening, right?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
That was
that's what you guys get for making me re-record.
Shh, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
So let's get right into it. I think we definitely probably the first thing should talk about is Frankie as Bobby, because this was big casting news and you guys were very excited about her, and I see why. So, you know.
Yeah, she was awesome. She was awesome to work with. She came in the first day great and stayed with it the whole time. And the amount of work she put into it was astounding. She came in very fit, and they had her working out with this ex-military guy like 4 hours a day for weeks to really buff up and fill the role and be the scariest person there. She just went for it the whole time.
Can I ask, like, when you guys were, what characteristics, I guess, define Bobby Draper to you when you were looking to cast? Like, what were the things you're like, this person has to nail this particular aspect to fit the part?
The show in general, from every end, the writers, the producers, the studio, everybody involved has been very committed to keeping The Expanse a really inclusive, diverse universe. So that's always a factor. You know, you kind of want the characters to resemble the characters from the books. But more than that, I think the thing that Frankie brought to, you know, she was an amateur boxer. She just had this physical confidence. When she never seemed like the smallest person in her room. She never seemed like she was shy or holding back. And we really wanted Bobby to be somebody who just, when she walks in the room, that's her room. And Frankie can do that.
And at the same time, she's got the acting chops to also be vulnerable, to also be soft, to also have this really amazing range that the character requires. And that's a hard thing to find. That's a tall order.
And speaking of tall, we wanted her to be tall.
I was going
to
say, that's literally tall because she's 6 foot, you know, right? She's tall.
Yep. Yeah, in the suit with the boots and everything on, I think she's like 6'2 or 3. She pretty much towered over everybody when she was wearing that thing.
She had a very, to me, she is a very Ripley-esque quality to her. Like, not that's aesthetic, nice. But I think it's really that, you know, I hate using like a trope saying like a strong female character, but she really embodies, like, the second she's on the screen, she's a very commanding presence, and that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Ripley's defining, and most people don't analyze it at this level, but I analyze aliens for a living.
That's your real
job. Ripley's defining characteristic. Yeah. Ripley's defining characteristic is competence. If you watch Alien, Ripley is always the most competent person in every scene. And in Aliens, she brings that competence to, I mean, the guy shows her how to use a gun once and she goes and takes on the entire alien horde with it. So I can see why you would say that, because Frankie and the character of Bobby, they are really defined by their competence. She's an absolute warrior, you know, a special forces operator at the top of her game. And she just has to project that air of confidence and competence in everything.
And I think considering like what her position is, you know, Bobby's position, that's part of the job. Like, I think it is important that competence shows, because you can't possibly be, you know, what her position is in the Marines and not be able to literally be dropped in any situation and know how to like figure out how to handle that situation.
And that is exactly what she brought to it. And also she wound up not just being, you know, Basil Exposition, we're going to put her in here and she'll do everything that needs to be done. She also wound up really engaging with the character as a human being, which was awesome to watch. I watching her kick all the ass and own the room and project that confidence and also be able to let you feel for who that woman is as a human being. That was what we needed from her. And that's what we got every time.
One of the things I really liked about the character and the way she was portrayed in the first episode is, you know, how gung-ho she is for war with Earth. And can you talk a bit about, I guess it's touched on in the episode and there's a lot more backstory to it in the books in terms of Martian terraforming and the history of that and why it's such a touchy subject at this point in the show?
In the universe, the Martian colony broke away from Earth. They're smaller, they're higher tech, they're entirely focused on this huge kind of generations long project with terraforming, like back in the Middle Ages when, you know, they were building cathedrals and one person would start making the bricks and their great grandchildren would actually finish the thing. It's that focused a society. And then Earth is the kind of power in decline. It's the one that has been the great power in the solar system and is kind of choking on its own inertia. And
in it's very the, we, timely, we have, by the way.
You know, come we on. Don't plan it that way. It just keeps working out. And the power struggle between the two of them winds up getting played out through proxy wars in the belt. And that's all stuff that's happened in the past. And there's all this history of saber rattling and threat. And the truth of the matter is that they're both very vulnerable. You know, anybody at the bottom of a gravity well is in trouble. They're in danger. Dropping rocks is a threat.
To me, the women stood out a lot in this episode. And you could see how, you know, for Bobby, she's she's thinking about Mars first and foremost, and her means of protecting that legacy is definitely through she wants war, you know. And whereas Naomi, she's also very much like a mother hen, and her means is a totally different approach, which we'll talk about with Dominique once she joins us a little bit later in the episode. And then Kris Jenner, you know, she's her means are an entirely different thing. So I think it's a really interesting dynamic that you, even in the first episode, it was a great way to like kind of like present her the way that she was presented. Another thing I really thought that was cool, since we're talking about her, is their armor, the Martian armor.
Yeah, how was right? that? How was that for you guys to see that realized on screen?
It's an interesting combination of making it as badass as you can possibly make it, and actually being able to have your actors walk around. Because of course we worked with the guys who wrote Iron Man. They're executive producers and writers on the show.
You can see a little bit of Iron Man in that those outfits.
Well, actually. The thing that we discovered by talking to them about it is, like most of the suits Robert Downey Jr. has in that show, he can't actually walk in them.
Of course, you're them- talking about films.
Uh-oh.
Like a power armor.
I wonder who that is. So Dominique just got here.
Hi.
We were trying to like get some stuff out of the way before we brought you into the conversation, but like more the merrier. We're talking about those awesome Martian power armor spacesuits that, you know, where that influence really like comes from. But don't worry, we're getting to you soon, so you can definitely interject whenever you want.
No, I was just gonna say, is Ty talking about a film that I haven't seen again? Because this happens a lot while we're shooting.
You haven't seen Iron Man?
I've seen Iron Man.
Okay, well.
She's like, don't condescend me, okay? I've seen Iron Man. We know your game. I'm glad there's another girl here to deal with the three of you. It's not just me having to deal with you.
Great. Great. I'm glad you're here.
I got your back.
Sorry. I completely interrupted. Crack on talking about the armor then.
Okay, so yeah, right. The Martian armor. Go ahead. Iron Man, Robert Downey Jr. Couldn't walk in it. Go on.
So he couldn't actually walk around in them or move or anything. And so we had a lot of conversations about making sure that our actors could actually act while they were wearing the armor. So they came up with a design. We hired a great company in LA that does all of the best armor design. And they came up with a design that looks really cool and actually allows the actors to move around and act. And that's actually, it turns out that's not an easy combination of things to do. So the suits were ridiculously expensive.
Yeah, it's the one thing I always said. You mentioned Iron Man. There was a scene in Civil War where Tony Stark calls Spidey. Out for Spider-Man and says underoos, and he can't lift his arms all the way to his face. You can see it. So it's good that you guys took that into consideration this time around.
But also, like, and Adam and I were talking about this a little bit before we got on with you guys about how that power armor looks. And I know you guys are really into trying to keep as scientifically accurate as possible. And, you know, we joked like, yeah, okay, it looks a little bit like the Iron Man suit. But what other kind of influences went into when you were even coming up with the concept of what that might look like? And did you really think about or talk to anybody, you know, in science, like, okay, in the future, how will our, you know, Marines and armies, like, how are they going to look? How are they going to go into war?
You know, they're working on a couple of different designs right now. You know, strength augmenting exoskeletons for soldiers to carry extra gear with them or whatever. And you know, definitely looked into that, but also trying to make it not just what we have now. So on the show, you'll notice there's no hydraulics on the suits. And then we were talking about whether or not to go with hydraulics or other things. And hydraulics make it really obvious that there's a strength augmenting element to it, but it also looks very narrow. It makes you look like a forklift. So what there is instead are these strips of red segmented metal that run all through the suit and connect every joint. And that's supposed to be, there's these faux muscle metal materials that they've been working with, where you run an electric charge through them and they contract like muscle, and then you relax the electric charge and it relaxes like a muscle does. And kind of the idea is that it's more of that sort of thing. So it's much slimmer as it's less likely to break underwear. It takes less maintenance, but it also still gives that element of strength augmentation that the armor should have to carry the giant gun that they have on their right arm.
There's also some of the constraints that we had just because we knew how this armor was supposed to be used. We knew that it needed to be small enough that it could be used on a ship. It could go through, you know, the doors and go through the spaces efficiently that these folks would need to go through.
Dominique, do you wish you got to, you know, rock one of those cool Martian armor suits?
The amount of times I tried to create reasons of why Naomi would be in it,
and
you
nothing.
Wouldn't believe. But I got turned down a lot.
But that's okay. I mean, you guys, you have your cool, you know, space suit. It's not shooting guns,
yeah,
out, you know,
really
bullets out of the back, but
ancient space suit. Yeah,
maybe you can get it like tricked out or something.
Yeah, I think we need like to pimp out our spacesuits because ours feels so old compared to the Martian ones. But I suppose, you know, it keeps in line with the story, blah, blah, blah.
Besides, how long would it take you to strip out of power armor for one of those sexy space scenes? I mean, that would take forever.
And how is having space sex?
I don't know what you're talking about.
It would take about 2 hours and require a couple of prop people running in to help.
Yeah, exactly.
moment would be lost by the time you're naked.
You can kind of see how long it took this time around to strip out of what we're wearing. So, yeah, I think just for time-saving reasons and to keep it sexy, we'll stick with the older ones.
Because the undressing montage. You know,
exactly. The entire Rosie crew has to chip in.
Yeah.
And
at some point, everyone on the Rosie crew has to show their bare ass on the show. That's basically what's happening.
Yeah. I agree.
Okay.
No, I do too.
Yeah,
I'm down with it.
Wait. Yeah, I can't wait to strip down. You just keep not letting.
I feel like I need to just mention that we are making Kaz wear a little belly. I mean,
I noticed that actually.
Yeah. And I know that it because he's incredibly fit. I mean, he totally doesn't have that belly, so we have to strap it on him. And I know it just kills him a little every time we do. But
yeah, he keeps trying to find reasons of why Alex would work out all of a sudden and be
like, lose weight.
And we're all like, no, dude, no, we know what you're doing.
Yeah, I told him in season 3, after all the stresses of season 2, his character is going to start stress eating, so we're going to keep putting progressively larger bellies on it as the show.
So it's gonna be like fat Leah Dama, except it's gonna be fat Alex.
You can do the thing like they did with Brad Pitt in Ocean's 11, where he was eating something in every single scene he was in.
Yeah. I want to see him flying the ship with a donut in his hand.
He would be like the Homer Simpson of the Rocky.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
So I mentioned earlier how it really the three women really seemed to like leave a mark with me this episode, and especially with your character and with Naomi and with Bobby, you're both very much, you know, mama bears, but your approach is very different. The characters' approaches are very different, and I just wanted you to talk a little bit about, you know, how Naomi's really the glue and how she's this episode really how she's bringing everybody together on the crew and what her motivation is.
I think for Naomi, she's very much a fixer. And I think she freaks out if there's not something to fix. And I don't think she's very good at fixing people, as she says. But when it comes to the Rosie crew, they're like her family. So I think if anyone, she's probably, you know, kind of burst to fix them. But I think what she actually sees, and I think women see this in men a lot, is I think because of what they've all been through, she can see the boys' humanity start slipping away. And I think, you know, I think if anything, if what Naomi is a voice for, especially because she's a belter, is the more human side of it and thinking more about the people in the situation. So I think what she tries to do is kind of grab all the threads of their humanity and try and hold them together and try and nurture that a bit just to keep them together and keep them thinking more along those lines rather than a kind of war state of mind or a kind of aggressive state of mind. So I think that's kind of her role and what she's trying to do. And I think it's part survival and it's part sympathy. I think she's very mothering in her own way. And I think that's just her way of doing that. That's how it's manifesting.
Yeah, it's kind of like there was that the scene where you and Thomas Jane are having a conversation. So it's Miller and Naomi. And Miller says of Naomi that she's sort of Amos's guiding light. And that's really kind of what she is for everybody.
Yeah, I have to ask, how quickly does Wes go into dead-eyed psycho mode? Is that something that he just carries around with him on set, or is it like a switch that he can flip on and off?
He's just like that every day in real life. There's no switch.
He was great in this episode.
He's not. He is just wonderful. I know he slips into going into like sociopath mode, but he understands and has taken on Amos's story so deeply that I just think, you know, he, in his head, he doesn't slip into being a sociopath. He slips into being Amos.
That is
what Amos is. But he has gone so far into that character that, it's not like everyone. It's not so far for him to slip into it because he has such an understanding of that character that he's created and an empathy that, you know, that's he's doing his job basically as an actor.
Does he get all method and like Jared Leto and start sending you guys like dead rats when he's like getting into psychopath Amos mode? Or
yeah, could you imagine? But with his understanding of Amos, we have a deeper understanding of Amos, and it fuels all of our character storylines and especially mine. So, you know, me and Wes talk a lot about our relationship and understanding Amos and where Amos comes from. And so I even find myself being quite defensive of Amos as a sociopath because I'm like, no, but you guys don't understand him. And then I'm like, oh no, he's a sociopath, definitely. So I just think, you know, like with any character you take on, you have to make them human. You have to have an understanding with them and their plight and compassion for what they've been through and an understanding of why they are what they are. And that's why Wes plays Amos so well, is because that's what he's done so well.
And then I want to ask specifically about filming the space battle scene from this episode. Obviously, the way it's shot, you guys are strapped in. Is it like it's a lot of grimacing in when you have high G maneuvers and things like that? What can you talk a bit about what that experience is like?
They're actually quite weird to shoot and probably my least favorite, because we have each other in each other's ears. We don't get to really look at each other and go off the other person, which I like to do. So they're quite difficult and they can feel quite cold to shoot. But now I know, you know, obviously after watching season one and seeing early cuts, what they look like. Now it's easier to shoot them because I know how they're going to look when they're put together. So it's kind of like hanging from a wire in the spacesuit. It's not the most great thing at the time, but you know that the end result is going to be brilliant, especially with Bob Monroe's VFX. So there's always a part of me that is like, do you know what? This is weird, but it's going to be fucking great in the end. So I just kind of use my imagination and go to that. I think we all do. And we try and all keep the energy up between each other. If we can feel any of it slipping, we're like, come on, guys. So there's a lot of that happens on the set while we're shooting those scenes. But yes, this one in particular, especially with the way Breck shot it, it's kind of awesome. I love it.
You know, speaking of her, you know, Naomi's relationships with the cast and whatnot. And I know I'm jumping back a little bit, but there was another moment in the episode where her and Holden are having a conversation and he brings up their relationship. And I really liked how instantly she was like, I'm not here because of you. And I thought there was like a really important, like, I love it because it's like, listen, I know you got abs, buddy. Okay. Like, I'm not doing this because of you. But let's talk like a little bit like about that, because it kind of seems like they're already maybe in two different places.
I think what's great, because even when I, you know, realized that this would be happening, I had reservations myself. Like, I didn't want Naomi to turn into this, melt and disappear into this relationship. But because we have such great writers and because she is, you know, a woman with her own mind, there has been heavy effort to not make that then be the sole, you know, reason of why she's there and why she's on the ship and why, you know, all of it, why the arc of her story, it doesn't evolve around their relationship. It's very integral and very important to her arc this season, because you kind of watch the bigger themes of the show play out on a smaller scale between them. And a lot of what brings them, has brought them together, kind of drives a wedge in between them. And so you get to see a very kind of, I think, a bit more interesting side of a relationship between two people, because, you know, you see a lot of relationships on screen and why they fall apart is normally quite generic. But I think with what we've done with these characters in the show, it's not a generic reason of what comes in between them, but it does happen. You know, beliefs or belief systems or political climates can pull each other apart, and without saying too much, it kind of influences what comes between them. So I think yes, Naomi maintains her own integrity and her own path and her own arc in the show, and Holden and their relationship is a part of it, but it's not the whole thing,
I guess. And along those lines, we have, you know, having, and this might be for the whole room, Ty, Daniel, and Dominique, for anyone who's read the books, without giving any big spoilers away, Dominique's Naomi's past certainly comes to the fore a little bit more. We got some hints of that in this episode. Is that something, again, without giving major spoilers away, can we expect kind of those threads to start bleeding out earlier on the show? I asked the tough questions.
You're definitely going to see the information about Naomi and about Naomi's identity as a Belter and her relationship to her community more to the fore in the show than they were in the early books.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the great thing about the show as a way to sort of tell a new version of the same story is in the books we're sort of locked into a different viewpoint characters, and we never really, until much later in the series, get to see inside of Naomi's head. But on the show, you know, Dom's right there. We can have her do stuff and have the camera follow her around, even though she's not, you know, in the book, a viewpoint character. So we get a much richer view of that character, you know, and Dom has the space then to do all the interesting stuff she's doing as an actress with the character. That's just things we can't do in the books, and the show lets us do them. It's a lot of fun.
I also think what's interesting about the show, which obviously you can't do in a book, is you get to witness her change, and you get to witness her fight with demons of what she should be and shouldn't be doing and what's good and bad. And so I think that's what makes the journey, Naomi's arc, interesting on the show, is that what you get to witness is her journey in deciding, and the conflict of the decision is what makes, what kind of keeps you on your edge of your seat throughout.
Very cool. You had mentioned that the space battle scenes were some of the more challenging stuff to do. Was there a scene from this episode in particular, the season two premiere, that stood out for you as one you really enjoyed digging into?
Oh my God, it's so vast. Let me just think.
I can tell you my favorite Naomi scene.
All right, yeah. In the meantime, go for it.
Was it the sex scene with her butt?
No.
That was mine. No
Nothing
offense.
Against the sex scene. I appreciate that you appreciated it. No, the conversation that she and Holden had when they were working on the Rossi, the one where he asked if she's scared and she said she's angry. That was such a pleasure to watch, and the interaction between the characters and the kind of combination of these two people who have just fallen into bed together and are still in that kind of giddy part of the relationship, with the fact that they're working on this incredibly dangerous instrument of destruction in the face of tremendous rage and darkness. That's great. And the way that it was so subtle and so understated and so effective and so genuine, that was my favorite Naomi moment in the first two.
I really loved that scene, actually. That was great to shoot. And Steven's great to work with. That is definitely one of my favorite scenes. And I think my scene with Miller
Yeah.
Yeah.
is also one of my favorite partly because Thomas Jane is just awesome and awesome to work with. And I really enjoy the development of Miller and Naomi's relationship over the course of the season. I think it's really cool. And I think what they kind of work out in each other and what he works out in me, we start to kind of see each other as being okay. And I like that scene that we have together where we start working that out. And yeah, not to spoil the episodes going forward, but it just keeps going on from there. And I love how that relationship builds.
And it's very cool how I think for me that they show different sides of being a belter. I mean, they're both the only belters on the Rossi at the time. And it's interesting to see that dichotomy there.
Yeah. Yeah, so we have a, you know, I asked Twitter if they had any questions for you guys. And we do have one that kind of applies to you, which you're tagged in. I'm sure you saw it. But was it at Immortal Root wants to know if you have any favorite words or phrases in Belter Creole, which I guess all three of you could actually answer.
I really enjoy pelotas.
What is it? What is it? You have to tell us what it means.
It's basically like a word for shit, like, but like floating shit.
Oh, even better.
Yeah. <Okay. laughs>
Because of course the Belters have a word for zero G shit.
Of course.
Yeah, that's amazing. So like,
that's one of my faves.
So, I mean, like, would you ever see yourself actually accidentally, like, using Belter, like, words in your actual everyday speech?
Not probably while I'm shooting, like, for sure. Not so much when I come out of being Naomi. It's just
that
too
would just
weird,
be weird
for everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or you find yourself nodding with your hands.
Yeah, it's just too weird. It's all too weird.
Ty and Daniel, how about you guys? Do you have a favorite Belter speech, phrase, or word?
The one, because we've got Dom here, I'm remembering there was one day we were shooting when she wanted to change one of the lines because she really wanted to find out what the Belter word for asshole was and put it in a line. So we had to get Nick Farmer, who was the linguist who did this, to track him down on Twitter and ask him to generate the Belter word for asshole. We went up with Jimong.
What is it?
Jimong.
Jimong. So that we could have it there right at the moment. That was awesome. That was fun.
You always have to start with curse words.
Yeah. That's the best part of making up a language. You have to make up all the swears.
Well, except I'm not a linguist, so I've got this linguist so I can go and ask and get really good answers instead of the stuff I come up with.
Awesome.
I have to say too, I mean, and I know it's different for Naomi and with Miller, but I really like how all the Belters have that accent. It's such like a small detail, but I really was like, it's really cool that even though they're not speaking, like they all have a very distinct accent. I don't know. I just
and Belter
amazing.
Haircuts.
Yes. They cut some great follicles.
I really hope that catches on and you love start seeing people haircut. Rocking the Belter haircut from here on.
Me too. Or just in cosplay, like just even there, that would be great.
Speaking of cosplay and fandom, I guess are you ready for the Naomi Holden shippers that are certainly going to be all about this relationship online?
Shippers get intense too, like when it comes to like relationships in shows and movies. People still think that Edward and Bella are together in real life.
Oh God. I mean, I'm interested to see how many people will ship it and how many people won't. I think there's going to be some people that are just going to be like, no, I'm not okay with this, and are still like a bit Namos inclined, and want me to be with a sociopath.
Wait, there was a ship. There was a named ship for Naomi and Amos. Namos.
I didn't know that.
That's fantastic.
And a hashtag Nolden. Yeah.
No, you already know the hashtags. They already have names. Oh, God, I'm learning so much today.
Well, I'm always on Twitter. I love Twitter and I love talking to all the fans. So, when last season there was Nolden and there was Namus.
The great divide of our time.
I want a Hamus hashtag. I want to see the Holden Amos shippers because those two have like that angsty hate towards each other that I think there's something else beneath it.
I think you're right.
I know. I'm shipping that.
We should have thought. Yeah, I'm shipping that too.
Let's go write fan fiction together about it, Dominic.
That's the great thing about Amos is you can ship him with anyone.
Yeah, no. Him and Alex, no problem. No problem.
Yeah.
No problem.
We had somebody yelling at us on Twitter because we didn't wind up with Amos and Prax together.
What?
Yeah.
Oh.
My favorite is that they're yelling at you on Twitter about it.
Because it was clear that they were in love.
Right.
Oh, my God.
How hard is it? This has been a running theme for me in this episode of The Churn. How hard is it to maintain your composure around Stephen Strait's abs?
I would just like to go on record as I know for a fact that Ty and Daniel expected me to be out of control.
No, it's all me.
It's Adam. Yeah, he's worse. No. He's worse.
And you know, it's just because the thing is, like, he's in that space suit and he kind of looks, you know, he's a handsome guy, but then he takes off the suit and you're just like, oh my God.
He was literally talking about this for a good 20 minutes before we started recording. I just want you to know that.
It's the biggest reveal of the episode
I don't know if I'm just like spoiled and quite used to them by this point. But yeah, I mean, they're pretty awesome. And there's some good abs in general. I mean, you may even get to see some more throughout the course of the season.
Wow.
Most namely Amos, which are also pretty awesome. So yeah, I'm kind of spoiled with that on the show. But I also have really good abs. So
you do. I did say earlier that, you know, I was impressed that Steven's butt apparently has to kick off every season is Steven's bare ass. But then I was like, you know what, though? Dominique's is better. Yours is better, I got to say. Yeah. So I'm giving props are due.
Thank you. I always instigate, like, push-up contests and stuff between the men on set, and they all buy into it, which is hilarious.
I heard you guys break into song a bit on set, too.
Oh, my God. I'm always singing. Yeah, we do. Me and Wes sing a lot. You know what I mean? It's heavy what we go through. So we have to lighten it.
All right. So let's talk a bit about everything that's happening on the political end with Earth and the UN. Because there's a lot. I mean, it's kind of hard right now to tell, like, who's on what side.
Part of the thing that we're doing with the book and the show is making the argument that on all sides of a political conflict, there are good and bad people. On all sides of a cultural divide, there are good and bad people. And any of these, even very apparently straightforward conflicts, are actually more and more complex and deeper and multifaceted the more you look at them. So, yeah, it gets a little dense because that's kind of part of the story we're telling. We've got Earth trying for ascendancy. We've got Mars trying to, you know, plant their flag in the solar system as the totally independent thing. We've got the Belters who are trying to be recognized as being human beings with, you know, rights and dignity. And none of those sides is completely clean, and none of those sides is completely dirty, and all of them wind up doing things that are horrible, and all of them wind up doing things that are noble. That's complicated.
I was really glad we got to hear Vassarala drop the F-bomb in this episode.
Alex does too.
Oh, me too.
Alex does too.
Yeah, as a book reader, I was so ready for more profanity from her.
and Sheree is such a wonderful, gentle personality. Otherwise, getting her to cut loose a little bit like that is a joy.
Can you speak a bit about the character of Vassarala? We got a lot more of her in season one than she was in Leviathan Wakes. Obviously, she wasn't in Leviathan Wakes. So can you talk a bit about bringing that character more to the fore earlier and kind of why and what that process was like?
Are you talking about bringing her into the first season?
Into the first season, where even now, I think at this point in the storyline in the books, we hadn't met her yet. Is that right? Am I crazy?
No. Well, yeah, that's right. Because we're at this point, we're still finishing up some of the events from the first book, even though we're in the second season, and she wouldn't have been in there. But the great thing about it, when we were very first discussing this, before we even started writing scripts for the first season, when there was just a few of us, you know, Mark and Hawk, the ETs who wrote the pilot, and Noreen, our showrunner, and then Daniel and I, the five of us just sitting around talking about what the show could be. The thing that Daniel and I kept repeating is these characters exist. I mean, Vassarala is somewhere doing things in the first book. We just don't get to see it because of the point of view structure of the books. And getting to talk out what her reactions would be to the things Holden is doing, and her frustration with him and his sort of information must be free worldview, and her frustration with how Earth and Mars are pushing back and forth while there's this larger threat looming that only she seems to be able to pay attention to. That's all really fun stuff. And getting to sort of add to the mythology of the books by including that in the show has been great. And especially now early on in season two, she's really starting to step up and exert her will in a way that we didn't really see. She was always a powerful character in the first season, but she was confused. She didn't know what was going on. She had a hard time really starting to dictate terms. But now in the second season, as she gets a growing understanding of what's happening and who the players are, now we can really see the puppet master, the person who's going to exert their will on the political landscape. And that's really fun stuff to write. And Shore, as an actress, she has a great time playing that kind of part. So she really just throws herself into it.
I know we're kind of like touching on the first season a little bit, and we actually have another fan question from Twitter, and they asked, now that, you know, season one is in the can, post-mortem, is there anything looking back at that season that you would have changed at all?
You have to understand, when I look at season one, I don't see what anybody else sees because we were there for so much of it. I remember every, you know, draft of the script that got changed before we filmed it. I remember the different takes that we talked about. I remember the ideas that we knocked around that didn't ever, you know, weren't the ones that made it to the screen. So are there things that I would change? I would like all of my best lines that got cut put back in because they were great because they were mine. there were a couple of places, especially, I guess, really early on when I think we maybe needed to talk about physics a little bit more with more people, but I don't know how much more we could have done that. We talk a lot about physics and inertia, and it's just so hard to keep track of that, you know, every now and then we slipped up, but I don't think it was a disqualifying event. I don't think it was a big deal.
Yeah, that's just one of the things that was so fun about that space battle in this episode is watching ships execute maneuvers that, you know, make sense with Newtonian physics and things like that. It's always, as a giant dork, it's fun to see that happen on screen.
That space battle was so good.
The part where Amos was stuck between the hulls?
Yeah.
Man, filming that was amazing. We were watching the dailies that looked like we had canceled Wes's contract. We're just going to beat him to death.
watching it made me think you canceled his contract. I was like, what are they doing to him? I didn't think he would survive it.
In the script, the line of description, because Daniel actually wrote that script, the line of description we used is Amos is tossed around like a rat in a dryer. and they took it literally and tossed him around like a rat in a dryer.
Some kind of gimbal or something? Is that how they were making that happen?
No, it was a practical set. It was our construction crew built these two gigantic walls that went up, I don't know, 25, 30 feet.
They were huge.
And then we just dangled Wes on wires and slammed him around and you know, moved the camera around to create a disorienting sort of zero G effective and stuff. We had a stunt guy come in for like the most egregious slams, but it's almost impossible to get Wes out of the rig. You know, you're like, okay, we're going to replace you now with the stunt guy so we can really bang him around. And Wes is like, no, I can do it.
I'm sure the insurance people are so happy to be hearing this right now.
you make him get out. You make him get out, but he really wants to do it. I mean, he's kind of our human wrecking ball. He's he's happy to get slammed around in there.
And yeah, it was just violent. It was just awful.
Let's talk a little bit about the OPA. I mean, we saw some factioning of that this time around with the Black Skies. Is that right? Black Sky. I always want to say Black Sun, but that's an entirely different thing.
Yeah, Black Sky.
Yeah, and that whole scene with Fred spacing a guy. How much of that can we expect to play out now, or is that scene kind of a symbol of the fact that Fred is taking control of everything?
Well, I mean, the fact that the OPA is not a unified body is really important, but both in the books and the show, and every opportunity we get to show that we're gonna try to take it. And the fact that they are not unified, that there are different factions vying for power, it becomes a really important runner in this entire season, because, you know, Fred is this really compelling character, and we wanted to find more interesting stuff to do with him as the season went on, because he's sort of the spokesman for that worldview, the Belter worldview, and creating really interesting conflicts for him arises naturally out of him trying to shepherd all these cats, you know, all these different OPA groups that all want a different thing, but all call themselves, you know, fly the same flag. It became a big part of what we did with all the scripts for the season. And in fact, led to my absolute favorite moment of the entire second season, which we'll talk about when we do episode 8.
So, okay. Stay tuned for that, everybody. 7 episodes to go. No, 6 episodes to go. So stick around.
So I would actually, you know, I want to say that you definitely showed how messed up the OPA is in this episode, especially when it came to needlessly killing a bunch of people for no reason that we're not armed. So and I think it's also interesting, you know, like Miller tries to be the one that kind of corrals them. But Miller's a little bit of a cowboy.
Miller was awesome in this episode.
He was awesome.
I really dug what happened with his character in this episode.
Yeah, the way the episode ended was fantastic.
I'm so grateful. I was telling Cher earlier when he shoots, and I can't remember the name of the scientist.
Dresden.
Yes, Dresden. Thank you. And I was so ready for like the pithy, I just shot somebody in the head and it's a big moment line. And for him to just silently walk away was such a beautiful moment.
That was a perfect ending to that episode. And also because you're not expecting it when he shoots him. I literally felt a little like jerk in my seat because I wasn't expecting it. But he's definitely, again, like kind of like with Christian, like you're not really sure what his end game is still.
One of the things that has been fascinating for me watching, you know, as Daniel said, we've seen every iteration of this and all the, you know, the dailies and the scripts and all that stuff. And what's really been interesting to me is now in the second season, you're starting to see why Thomas made some of the choices he's been making since literally the first episode. Thomas had this idea of this character, because he read the book before he did the show, and he had a lot of conversations with Mark and Hawk about what they were going to do with the character, and you know had concerns that, because the character in the book is definitely not a black or white character. He's a very great character, and Thomas really wanted to not lose that. And of course, the writing team on the show is very committed to keeping it. And so it really, you start to see that Thomas had this idea of what that character's arc was from the first moment, from the first frame of film that we shot of him. He knew what he was going to do, and he's been slowly doing that over, you know, 12 episodes now. And you're starting to see it, some of that choices he makes in that scene at the end of episode 2 are paying off subtle things he's been doing for 12 episodes now. And it's as a person who's never been an actor and didn't really understand, I think, before this, how much art goes into, you know, the profession of acting. It's been fascinating to watch a guy with that level of skill doing the work that he's doing. I'm actually blown away by it. Daniel, I wrote that episode and we watched it, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm seeing stuff now that he was totally setting this up last season.
The thing that I particularly like about how that moment came down is he told you at the beginning of the episode what he was going to do. But he's sitting there with Holden in the med bay, and they're talking about justice. Miller told you what he was going to do. And then this moment came, and he did it. And whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, it doesn't matter. It's what he was going to do.
He does stand by his convictions. You got to say that.
That's a character we really like in fiction, that the guy who decides that he can unilaterally mete out justice like that, the one who decides that he has the right to make that kind of judgment and take that kind of action, that's totally celebrated in literature. And it's not something we actually admire in people.
Right. And I think it's interesting, like Holden and Miller are kind of two opposite sides of the same coin with that, because Holden is this idealist, but to the point where it would kind of be annoying if you had to deal with that guy in real life.
Yeah.
One more question. When you talk about Thomas Jane and what he's brought to the character, and I guess this is kind of with all the characters on the show and the actors playing them, are they given input into what they actually say? Can they change a line? Do they improv at all? Or is it all pretty much what's on the page?
There's always going to be some flexibility. There are line changes that come out of early rehearsal. You know, you write something and it looks great on the page, and then you have all the actors in a room rehearsing, and you realize, oh, that didn't work. That was a little clunky. That line doesn't really follow that other line. And you're going to make changes there. But on set, I mean, the actors are going to play around a little bit. And when you get an actor like Thomas, who's, I don't know, how many hundreds of hours of film has that guy done? You know, he's got an instinct for a moment. A good director, a smart director, is going to let him explore that instinct a little bit and see if maybe he's seeing something that the rest of us didn't see. And sometimes they do. Sometimes the actor sees something you didn't see. Generally, what you ask for is you ask to get both versions. So the director will say, yeah, go ahead and try that thing you want to try, but please also give me one take as scripted. And that way the editor has both choices, depending on how it works out. But there are a lot of things on screen, especially in Thomas's scenes, where he just had an instinct for something. He tried it out. Once we got into the editing bay, it was clear that his version was a little better, or sometimes a lot better. And, you know, that's the one that you wind up using. You can't be angry about that. You can't be angry when somebody comes along and makes your stuff better.
Everything that I'm seeing of him in this show, like, it's really hard to like think, oh, this is the same guy that played Mickey Mantle or was like, you know, all jacked and blonde and the sweetest thing. Like, it's just, he really, it's watching like an entirely different person, and it's very impressive. I know that we spoke when we were talking about, you know, doing the podcast, you guys said that there would be some things that you would want to shout out that you're into right now. Is there anything that you want to give a special nod to? Any books, games, shows, anything?
I know it has nothing to do with what we're working on here or the genre we're playing with or the tone, but I cannot get enough of The Good Place.
Oh my God, I love The Good Place.
That is such a smart, funny, humane, hilarious piece of work, and it's so not what I expected at all.
Yeah.
It's so forking good.
It's so forking good.
I just love that show.
Yeah, and we're not just saying that because it's an NBC.
No, I actually haven't watched it yet, but everybody I know, and
it's
especially
so good.
Especially like people I know who are typically science fiction and fantasy people.
Because I think it's genre
really
adjacent. I would say it's genre adjacent. There's definitely...
No, it's absolutely a genre show.
Yeah.
It's
so clever.
I mean, it's the Matrix. It's a created world where, you know, it's populated by people who have been taken from the real world. We have Michael's story about what it is, but is his story true? Is it accurate? You don't know.
Yeah.
And it's a world in which imbalances in behavior cause dramatic physical effects to the world. I mean, it is totally a genre show. It's just cute and clever and
funny.
It's funny, and who knew Kristen Bell was so funny? I mean, she's fucking hilarious in that.
Yeah. And honestly, I'm happy anytime I see Ted Danson back on TV, because, you know, I think that a lot of people, sadly, like this generation, they missed out on Cheers, which is still one of the greatest sitcoms ever to run. And, you know, I think he's definitely, people don't give him enough credit for how good he is as a comedic actor, I think.
Yeah, he's amazing. He has taken a role that could have been terrible and made it.
Cheers was the sitcom that was so great that it spawned a spinoff that is one of the greatest sitcoms.
I know.
I mean, that's pretty hard to do. Yeah.
Which then spawned one of my favorite pieces of fan art, which was a comic book cover, a Marvel What If, that was What If Frasier Joined the Fantastic Four.
That is a deep cut right there.
I saw that. I think it was at either New York or San Diego Comic Con this past year, and I must have laughed for about 5-10 minutes straight.
My probably favorite thing, and I know we're not talking about anything sci-fi, but like with Cheers, is that it gave us Woody Harrelson. And anybody that knows Woody Harrelson now and they associate him with The Hunger Games and like with Zombieland is such a different character than the Woody he was on Cheers, which is just makes him even better, like having been watching him for so long. So yeah, but Ted Danson, definitely I'm down with The Good Place. Definitely. I co-signed that shout out.
Did I make you watch The Good Place, Daniel?
No, I found it myself.
I was telling everyone else to watch it.
You seconded quickly. Yeah. what else is good has been?
I mean, that could be the shout out for the week.
Yeah,
it's The Good Place, and we're all down with that. So,
yeah.
And with that, I mean, we're going to wrap up today. So everybody listening, make sure to subscribe and give us a 5-star rating on iTunes, because we would give you 5 stars, because that's why we do this.
Yeah, and join us for the rest of the season. We're going to be doing this for every single episode. Obviously, shout out and thank you to Dominique Tipper for joining us.
Yes, thank you, Dominique. And
and to Stephen Strait's abs. I got to give one more shout out to Stephen Strait's abs. That's it. I'm done.
And I'm going to have a little sidebar with Adam because he's starting to creep me out. But yeah, we'll talk to you guys next week when we cover episode 3, which is really kind of episode 2, but it'll be episode 2 for us, but episode 3 of...
Right.
The Expanse. And if you have any questions, comments, you know, shout us out on Twitter @SciFiWire. And we'll see you guys next week.
Yeah.